Well, welcome to Black History Matters 365 with your host, Joanne Skate, the Marketplace Entrepreneur. It is a delight that you have joined us in the audience today, and I'm excited about this podcast today because we have, to me, one of the giants of our time. He has marched along with some of the greatest of the greatest. What's so incredible about this guest that I have today, him and John said that they are brothers. He's a close confidant to John Lewis and has marched alongside of him and even developed some incredible programs on Lewis, and just a brother to him. And I'm excited to have him today because we know that we are mourning John Lewis's passing, a great giant himself and done so much for our country, for his community, and for his family. It is a pleasure to have today, audience. I want to introduce to some that might not know him, and then some that know him and celebrate him every single day because of his great accomplishments. And then that is the one and only Dr. Bernard Lafayette Jr. Good afternoon, Mr. Lafayette. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic this morning, just really celebrating that we were able to get you because I know that you are a busy man and your schedule is like doing so many talk shows now because of your great friend, John Lewis. You're having to speak on his behalf. So I just want to say thank you so much for taking out the time to join Black History Matters 365 because I think it's important that for you to be here today and to speak not only of yourself, but also of John Lewis for us and give us some clarifications on some things. But I want to, before we get started with you, I definitely want to do a little bio. I love to do a little bio of the sketches of the guests. And the reason why is because a lot of people don't know the wonderful accomplishments that you, a history maker and an influencer, has already made. And so I'm going to do a little bio before we jump into this wonderful interview, sir. I would like to start with an incredible quote from your best friend, John Lewis. It says, "It does not matter what language you speak or the color of your skin. It does not matter whether you worship one God, many gods, or no gods. We are one people and one family," by John Lewis. Does that sound like John Lewis?
Very much like John Lewis.
Yeah, very much like him. Awesome. So here we go. We're going to go in a quick bio of you because I love this. And I cannot even touch on all the things that you have done and that are great. But hopefully these highlights will give our audience a little bit more about who Dr. Bernard is. First, Dr. Bernard is an ordained minister. A lot of people don't know that. A longtime civil rights activist, an organizer, and an authority on nonviolent social change. You are the co-founder of the SNCC, which stands for Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And you started this as a co-founder in 1960. You were a core leader of the civil rights movement in Nashville, Tennessee, and also in Selma, Alabama in 1965. You directed the Alabama Voter Registration Project in 1962 and was appointed by the one and only Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to be National Program Administrator in 1968 for the Poor People's Campaign, which I love that campaign too. And Dr. Bernard, you earned your BA at American Baptist Theological Seminary in Nashville, Tennessee, and your EDM and your EDD from Harvard University. Taught at many, many different schools, but the one that pulls out the most is Alabama State University. And I think you taught at Emory as well. And then lastly, some publications that you have actually done. I was really impressed with this. A curriculum and training manual for the Martin Luther King Jr. Nonviolent Community Leadership Training Program, and your doctorate on peace and nonviolence, Campus Ministry and Social Change in the 60s for Duke University Review. You wrote there. And then The Leader's Manual, A Structured Guide and Introduction, King Jim, Nonviolence with David Jensen. So a long, long list of different accomplishments that you have done, but I don't even think I gave it justice. So I just want to just say that thank you for being a giant for us and laying the path. So now let's jump into the interview and kind of tell us, with all these accomplishments and where you are today, what are you feeling right now? Talk about some of those accomplishments and how they actually made who you are, contributed to who you are today. Tell us about you.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to share your audience those experiences. And it caused some deep reflections on my part during this period because of the loss of John Lewis and of C.T. Vivian within a 24-hour period. When you think about it, that's very short period. I grew up in Tampa, Florida, Ybor City, and I had the opportunity to be in a diverse community because Ybor City is it's made up of Cubans and people from West Indies, people from various other, you know, countries and that sort of thing, as well as Asians, those from Japan and China and other places as well. So I had the opportunity to interact as a child with the different ethnic groups, but we went to segregated schools, and that's when we separated from each other, and so we didn't play together, we just waved at each other because we went to different schools. But I went to Philadelphia right after the war. My family moved there, and I went to an integrated school the last 2 years of my elementary school, and I was a commencement speaker. our class, and it was a black teacher, Miss Ward, who tutored me because I was like a half year behind because of the difference in the grade levels and that sort of thing from the South to the North. I even remember my speech, and the title of the speech was Living and Working Together. And it was no coincidence because I was very much interested in that subject, and used to work very hard to try to, you know, make sure that people interact with each other. When I moved back and finished high school and junior high school and that sort of thing in Tampa, Florida, I went on to college, Nashville, Tennessee, at the American Baptist Theological Seminary. My grandmother insisted that I would go because she said she saw a mark in my forehead. It was an indication that you would be called to preach. I only saw the chicken pox.
The mark of the chicken pox.
Yeah. The hole in my head.
Right.
That's the only hole I had in my head at that time. But I ended up being John Lewis's roommate. He was a year ahead of me in school, so I, you know, was editor of my high school newspaper and that sort of thing. So I was up on things pretty good. I was interested. I got a four-year scholarship in journalism at Florida A&M. But my grandmother said I had to go to, you know, seminary because I was going to be a preacher. So I listened to my grandmother. And So, yes, that's right. He was a year ahead of me, so I had an advantage because he had already taken the courses that I was taking. So he was like a tutor, okay? So that was some advantage that I had there for him. So we both grew up in the South, and we experienced segregation as young children, that sort of thing. So we used to talk about that a lot, and we were very much concerned and disturbed by that, and made of a commitment that we were going to do something about that. I had an incident with, when I was about 7 years old, with my grandmother riding the streetcar. And what happened was, we used to get on the trolley car. You know, they had track, and they also had a electric wire top, you know, a trolley car. And we used to have to put our money in the front, the receptacle there next to the driver, a conductor. Then we had to get off the streetcar and walk along the streets to the back door of the streetcar. And sometimes the conductor would let us put our money in. And once we got off and started walking to the back, he would close the doors and the steps and then take off with our money.
Oh my goodness.
So as a little boy, I used to travel with my grandmother, and I used to always run to the back and jump on the steps. Because if you can hold the steps down, you can keep the doors open. And even if your car is running, you can hop on, okay? Mm-hmm. If it's gonna be slow enough. But this time my grandmother was running behind me, and her heel got caught in the cracks, you know, around the track. And she fell. She was a heavy set woman, that's what we call them in those days, heavy set. And she fell in the middle of the street, you know, with her heels on, all dressed up. I jumped on the steps of the trolley car to keep the door open, but now I had to jump off the steps to get my grandmother out of the middle of the streets. I was so upset at 7 years old. But I remember saying something to myself. In fact, I'm told that everybody around age 7 has some experience that they will never forget. Mm-hmm. Around age 7. All you have to do is think about it. And there's some, you know,
some type of experience.
Yes.
Their lives.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So I remember that experience, and I remember saying to myself, when I get grown, I'm going to do something about this problem. So I decided that that's what I was going to do with my adulthood. So I only remember childhood because I wanted to get grown so fast. They used to call me Little Man. Because I used to have, you know, I used to sit and have conversations with my father, you know?
Yeah.
The two of us used to have real rap sessions, okay, in those days.
Yeah.
So anyway.
So like old head.
Yeah. I was a old head. They called me Little Man, okay? Mm-hmm. So anyway, when I was in college, John Lewis and I used to talk about those early experiences we had. So we had a lot in common. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to do something about the problem, and so did I. So he told me about these workshops they were having that Jim Lawson was conducting in Nashville. And he tried to get me to go to the workshops, but I said to myself, I'm too busy. I grew up, you know, as a fellow who just worked a lot. Mm-hmm. Okay, I used to deliver coffee, you know, to the merchants on the block there in Tampa, Florida, before I went to school, like 5:30 in the morning. So as a little boy, I used to get, and guess what? Coffee cost 10 cents, and I got 10 cents to deliver it. I was Mr. Coffee.
Yeah, Mr. Coffee, I like that. Rose early and serve people coffee.
Yes, I would go to the restaurant and get a whole tray of coffee and bring back to the merchants. So we all worked together. I was used to working. I was the assistant librarian there at the college, and the librarian became an expectant mother and had difficulty. So I had to end up being the librarian. Yeah, right.
Oh my goodness. What a great position though to be.
Yeah, you had to sleep in the library at night. Stay up half the night.
He read a lot of books, so that opportunity to read.
Absolutely. Then He's janitor of the second floor. And then I used to work in the kitchen, washing dishes, you know, et cetera. So I could get some of the extra food, you know, and some pot liquor and some extra things left over.
Did you say pot liquor?
Yes, pot liquor.
What is pot liquor?
Oh, that's right. We're talking about a generational gap here. Pot liquor is a juice that comes from the collard greens.
Oh, okay.
You see, that's what they used before they had baby food in Kansas. You would take the pot liquor, and you take the cornbread and stick it in the pot liquor, soften it up, and that's what baby food. Yes, that's what we grew up on, baby food, like that. So I still like that even today. Because I have to explain what pot liquor is. Pot liquor. Okay. Liquor. Right. So I have to explain that even today when I go to restaurants and the young people. But anyway, I was too busy to go to any workshops. So I told John Lewis, I said, I don't have time to go to any workshops. He said, well, we talk about these things at night in the dormitory all the time. So he said, why don't you just come in? So I said, okay, I'm just going to come so he could shut his mouth. I went to the workshop. Jim Lawson Jr. was, conducted those things. And I got so excited about the nonviolence training. They were talking about Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King and civil disobedience. It was focused on the lunch counters in Nashville, downtown area. So that was just, okay, right down my alley, so to speak, literally, okay? And I started going, and that was the thing that started me in the direction of the nonviolent direct action and learning more about Martin Luther King and that kind of thing, et cetera. So John and I became very close because here we were roommates, and also he was one of the leaders in the Nashville Sit-In movement, along with Marion Barry, who was one of the mayors of Washington, D.C., and Diane Nash and Jim Bevel. And so we really, and John Lewis, and we kicked that off, and that was the beginning of that sit-in movement and my involvement in the nonviolent direct action.
Very good. So early on, you were already thinking about things like this. I think that's first in the New York Times opinion. You talked about how you and John, your minds were already there when you're in your early age about making a change with social justice and changing things. You talked about that in the New York Times opinion section, that the title was, and I loved it, it says, "The First Time John Lewis and I Integrated Buses." So as you're talking about the whole came there to Nashville and end up being a part of Freedom Riders, you and John had already tested or did a actual bus ride in the front of the bus. I thought that was really, really good, that story there. So you were already doing most of what people were trying to get to, you and John were.
Well, what happened is when we decided to focus downtown lunch counters, the Greyhound bus station was downtown and had lunch counters. And so actually, once we desegregated the lunch counters at the bus station, and it was a little different at the bus station because we desegregated all the other counters and the manager at the bus station had agreed. But you know what? And see, that's why what we're talking about today in terms of the issues and problems, a lot of people don't know this, but the most discriminatory group, the people who are victims of discrimination, on all levels are older Black women. Because remember, they worked very hard on farms and stuff like that. They didn't have any income. They had no Social Security. They had any kind of security. But they worked very hard. and they worked for white folks. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any paycheck coming in that had Social Security connected with it. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that you don't stay young, you get old.
You get old.
Yeah. And then you can't work anymore. And then if you get sick or something like that or whatever, then you're really challenged. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. And older Black women live a little bit longer. So that means when they get sick, they sick longer. They have to take medication longer. Mm-hmm. Okay? All that. So this is what they experience. Now, what am I getting to? Hard for you to believe, because it was hard for me to believe, that even though we desegregated the lunch counters downtown, everything was desegregated. The waiting room, the restroom, there's no use having the lunch counters integrated and segregated restrooms. Okay. So they desegregated the restrooms and the waiting room and all that. Now, when older Black women, those who carry the bags and stuff where they've been working all day and they got to go to travel somewhere, you know, and they mm-hmm. go to the bus station. Do you know what? Even though everything else was integrated, they sent these older Black women back through the alley in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Okay, and they ate on porcelain tables in the kitchen with grease dropping out of the ceiling. Mm-hmm. So we tested it. They told us this was happening. This was after the desegregation of lunch counters. And we couldn't believe it. Because after all, why didn't they serve everybody else? So I, along with a couple other people, went and met with the manager. And he said, no, we don't discriminate. I told my staff and everybody, you know. Mm-hmm. So here's another point. We told the manager, I said, you see that white fellow sitting over there on the stool? He's with us. And he told us everything you did. Oh, that's why it's important to have integrated, okay, and everybody mm-hmm. participating with you. So I said, okay, now we got to make a point. So we had to go back through this again because we've gone through the sit-ins and all these things. So we went and we had an all-night sit-in at the bus station in Nashville, the Greyhound bus station downtown, because we wanted to make our point. And you know what the manager did? He locked the doors, turned out the lights. Yes.
In Nashville.
That's right. He called the police. And the police said they had desegregated all, we had desegregated all the other places, so he wasn't going to get involved in that. So the policeman just came and looked and we kept going. He even put tape on the refrigerator, the freezer, as if we going to cook. We sat there all night. We carried our books because we had to study for class. Well, long story short, about 5:30 the next morning, I told him I had to get up and go to make a phone call. And the phone booth was out there in the lobby. And they let you out because they didn't want you in anyway. So they let me out and then locked the door behind me so I wouldn't come back. So I went in the phone booth, and they had the folding doors in those days. And some cab drivers who had been out there all night, it was in November, and you know, they usually drink their coffee and wait for the bus to come so they can have rides, you know, and that kind of thing. And they were pointing their fingers at us and all that kind of stuff, sticking their fingers up all night because they couldn't get any coffee because the place was closed. It was closed because we had a sit-in. So one of them came and pushed the door open with his foot, okay, and dragged me out of there, put a headlock on me, and pulled me out of the bus station and about 12 or 10 cab drivers started beating me up. They knocked me down on the pavement in the floor, yeah, okay. And then they kicked me. My coat, I had a little short coat on, you know, and they just knocked me all around. But every time they would knock me down, I would get back up and stand and look at them. Mm-hmm. I stared right at their eyes. Because in nonviolence, what you have to do is make sure that you do not conform to their expectations.
Very good.
But if somebody hits you or kicks you, you're supposed to run. Or you're supposed to fight back. Or you're supposed to plead for your life. I did neither of those things. I just stood and looked at them. Mm-hmm. Now, it's important for lesson for people to learn in terms of nonviolence. You don't sit there and do nothing. What I was doing was fighting back with my eyes because I was looking at their eyes. And what did they see when they saw me? They saw no fear. Mm. And what they were doing didn't work because they were thinking that I would run or do something else. In fact, one of them shouted out, okay, catch him, catch him. How are you going to catch somebody who's not running?
Right.
Okay. So I'm sitting there looking at them. No, I didn't run. No. So
was this your first experience with being beaten? Because I know you guys went through a lot with this nonviolence, carrying that out. Was that your first experience with the Greyhound bus of someone attacking you?
No. During the sit-ins, we were sitting in the other lunch counters. They pulled us off there and beat us. We had to go through a whole lot, so we were used to that. But these cab drivers were out of breath, and I was standing there very calmly. So I finally said, if you gentlemen are through, I need to finish making my phone call. Please excuse me.
Wow.
And they didn't know what to do. And I wiped the shoe print off my face where they had kicked me. Mm. And I walked away back into the, you know, waiting room. Two policemen came and grabbed me and arrested me. One was older and one was younger. The younger one, who's just out of the academy, no doubt, because he looked very young, he said, well, what are we going to charge him with? The older guy looked at him and said, fighting on the streets. So then we walked along a little further, going towards the paddy wagon, and he said, well, who was going to say he was fighting with? And so the older policeman said, well, grab one of them. So they did grab one of those guys who were beating me up, and they put me in, and then they threw him in, and he put his head, hands over his head, and was scared, because I said, no, I'm the same on the inside as I am on the outside. Yes. Mm-hmm. And when we got downtown, the others came and got my bond money and bailed me out of jail. And guess what else happened?
What's that?
You put up his bond.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's what nonviolence is all about. Yeah. Because he had to go back to work. He had to, you know.
I mean, that's like killing people with kindness. It's like, that's what you did during those times, those difficult times when they were against you. You were more kind. That's what it's, or showed more love. Or, right.
They show you hate, mm-hmm. you show them the massive amount of love. Mm-hmm. So you defeat hate, but right. you do it with love. So it's not doing nothing. Nonviolence means that you're doing a whole lot. And see, this is the thing that John Lewis, for example, oh no, he just kept giving more. The more they take from him, the more he gave to others. And that's what nonviolence was all about. And so we practiced that along the line. But the point I wanted to make is that the Greyhound bus station is a place where we decided we were going to not just go down to the bus station and grab to an integrated bus station and then get on a segregated bus. So John and I decided we were gonna, okay.
Do it.
Yes. So I got behind the driver in the first seat and he got the other one. Rode on down to Troy, Alabama. The driver tried to get us to get off the bus, you know, and that kind of thing, but we wouldn't pay any attention to him. So he was angry. Mm. Like he rammed his seat backwards off the rail and punched a hole in my suitcase, because it would have been a hole in my leg if I hadn't had my suitcase. Mm-hmm. But we did have our suitcases, because, you know, we didn't know where we were thrown off the bus or not. So he drove on down to Troy, and I went on down to Tallahassee and then on to Tampa. But that was our first Freedom Ride.
And then Freedom Ride, you joined Freedom Riders after that.
Yes.
Right. And you had already experienced it, which is great. It just made sense for you to be a part of the Freedom Riders. The Freedom Riders, a lot of people know about them, but what was one of your worst experiences and best experiences with the Freedom Riders?
Well, the worst experience was when we got to Montgomery, Alabama, after leaving Birmingham. In fact, that's when I was able to start with the Freedom Riders. Lewis applied for the original Freedom Ride out of Washington, D.C., sponsored by CORE. And I also applied. We both were going to go together because we'd been on Freedom Rides already. And John Lewis was able to go because he was 21 years old that, you know, in 1961. And I wasn't going to be 21 until July. So I needed parental permission. Mm-hmm. If you weren't 21, you had to get parental permission. So I sent the papers off, you know, and my father, you know, I called him and I didn't get any my papers back. And so I said, did you get those papers I sent to you? And my father said, yes, I did. Yeah, I believe I did. So I said, could you go ahead and sign right away and send them special delivery, because I'm, you know, I have to make a deadline here for my application. So I was the first one to go to college in my family, so I assumed that he was going to think it was related to college, you know. He said, do you think I didn't read the papers? And I said, well, I was, in my mind, I was saying I was hoping you wouldn't read them, just sign it, you know, send the papers on back. You know what he said to me? He said, I'm not going to sign your death warrant.
Wow.
So that was his attitude towards that. So I couldn't go on the original ride. But once it was stopped with violence in Anniston, Alabama and Birmingham, those of us in Nashville decided to continue. And John, we organized ourselves. We had groups. Okay, so we had a backup group, in other words. So we didn't have to stop. And John Lewis led the first group in the Birmingham, and I led the second group. Once, you know, they were arrested, I launched the second group. And then we met in Birmingham, and of course we continued on into Montgomery. So the violence in Montgomery is other violence that you ask about. And I was there on the platform when the mob came out of the bus station and started beating up the reporters. They were beating up the people. These were white reporters they were beating up. I had never seen them beat up white men like that. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And these were professionals, okay? I saw the reporters, I mean, and they smashed cameras on folks' heads. I mean, this was terrible. Because the reporters took a bus ahead of us so they could be there when we arrived, you know? And my goodness, and I knew we were going to be next. So I said, in fact, when we started riding into Montgomery on a Saturday morning, it was very quiet, no cars running, no people walking on the street. So I knew something was going wrong. So there's a picture of me on the bus, you know, in some of the museums and stuff. So I stood up and told the Freedom Riders, I said, I want each of you to get a partner and stick with that person no matter what happens. And we're going to have a mass meeting at First Baptist later on. So if you get scattered or something like that or whatever, just make your way to the church. Okay? We supposed to have had rides for us, but when we got there were no rides. It was one nightcap. When we, that reporter, the reporter started getting beaten up. Now, the armed guard told me to sit down and shut up. when I was telling the Freedom Riders, you know, and giving them instructions. Mm-hmm. And I, a little skinny fellow then, you know, and I looked at him and I said, "You're in charge of the troops. I'm in charge of the Freedom Riders." He was stunned because he probably never had a little skinny black fella telling him, okay, telling him to shut up. Mm-hmm. He's got a drawn bayonet, okay? Mm-hmm. But when we got to the bus station, they all disappeared. The helicopters disappeared. They were supposed to give us protection. The governor had agreed, but when they got to the bus station, they disappeared. So I was there when they knocked Jeb's word, okay, the white fellow, the pictures of him, you know, with his teeth knocked out, et cetera. Mm. It was only 10 years ago that I had to tell him that he was not knocked over the rail one time. He was knocked over the rail 5 times. He didn't know that.
Wow.
It was the first time they hit him and knocked him out. Unconscious. In all those years, he never knew that, you know, they knocked him over 5 times. Okay. They tried to kill him. Then they hit John Lewis in the head with this Coca-Cola crate, and it was a metal strip on the side that cut the gash in his head. I saw him when they hit him. They came after me. And this guy.
What did that do to you? Were you afraid?
This guy with bro-gang shoes on was coming, and I could tell that he had planned to kick me in a certain place. Mm-hmm. And I went down to protect myself, and he kicked me in the ribs.
Mm.
Okay? Mm-hmm. 3 broken ribs all through the Freedom Rides. Yeah. Like nobody ever knew.
All through the rides? 3 yeah. broken ribs? See?
Because them buddies, they would have gotten me off the Freedom Ride if they'd known mm-hmm. I had 3 cracked ribs. So I kept my mouth closed. So I learned to suffer. Mm. So experiences that you go through, you learn how to endure. And that's what nonviolence is all about.
Enduring.
Mm. Enduring, okay? Mm. In other words, you don't turn back, even if you're knocked back. And that was a symbol of John Lewis.
You've been listening to Dr. Bernard Lafayette Jr., civil rights activist and freedom rider, interview part 1. Join us next time for part 2 on Black History Matters 365. Thank you for listening to Black History Matters 365, supported by the revolutionary curriculum BH 365, an inclusive account of American history.